This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 87. Can we please reactivate the defendant? I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including music awards for La La Land Records, the re-release of The Next Generation on DVD, the fan's choice for most skilled Starfleet doctor, and some more tidbits about Star Trek Into Darkness. Then in the feature, we're joined by Larry Nemechek to discuss the extended cut of TNG's The Measure of a Man. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing actually quite well this weekend. Thank you. I got a pink DS, so I've been playing Fire Emblem all weekend, and I'm looking forward to watching the Oscars tomorrow.
Yeah, we are recording a day early this week because the Oscars are coming up, and I cannot see them live here where I am, I guess, Greg, but you're planning to sit down. Anything you're looking forward to in the Oscars?
Well, I mean, the one thing, of course, is that Argo is going to win Best Picture. I'm saying that now, and that'll probably mean that it'll lose, because as we've learned, while on the Observation Lounge, if I mention something, it does better, on the Ready Room, if I mention something, it crashes and burns. So it's now somewhere in the middle. Sorry, Argo. Sorry, Ben Affleck. But the other thing is actually this article that just went up on StarTrek.com by friend of the show, Larry Nemechek, who will be joining us later on in the show for the feature. He wrote an article about Charlie Star Trek, who did pass away earlier this year, back in April, and he's actually going to be honored in the, you know, the in memoriam section of the Oscars, where they remember important people who passed, you know, in the last year.
Yeah, and as they do the reel of for the memoriam, they're actually going to be using one of Larry's photos that you'll be able to see on the broadcast.
Right, and I think it's this picture that's here on StarTrek.com. Now, they call him Charlie Star Trek, but his full name was Charles Washburn, and he was an assistant director for Star Trek. And he was, I believe, the first African-American assistant director ever, or at least for Paramount. I'm a little fuzzy on that exactly, but you know, this was not a good time, you know, in Hollywood to be a black man. You know, he says the only people on the Paramount lot or the Desilu lot were him, Nichelle Nichols, and the shoeshine guy. So he was definitely, you know, breaking new ground at Desilu in Hollywood, just period, back in the 60s. And it's great that now, even though he's not a really well-known name, you know, to the average viewer, this is something they're going to bring it up on the Oscars, and people are going to say, oh, who was that? Remember what he did and who he was.
Yeah, and it's very appropriate that Star Trek in the original series would be the vehicle for him as well, for everything Star Trek represents. And Larry says to, you know, make sure when you're watching the Doomsday Machine, listen for when Scotty says, Washburn has a report.
Ah, right. Exactly. So yeah. I believe we'll see this picture of Tim with Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner. Just notice that as it passes. Well, I guess notice it past tense, since you'll be listening to this after the Oscars. But I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that tomorrow.
Yeah, and there's a couple more in there, and then there's one here of him taken not too long ago at his desk, actually just a year before he died, and I think that's going to be in there as well that Larry
right.
took.
Right, that's the picture Larry took that they're actually going to use in the broadcast itself.
Right. So if you want to know more about this, we'll put a link in the show notes. Go over to StarTrek.com. It's right up there on news. And Greg, while we're giving shout-outs, we should also just mention that as we record, yesterday was the birthday, would have been the birthday, of Majel Barrett.
Ah, yes. She, of course, was the oft-remembered number one from The Cage. And it's too bad that she never came back. to be in Star Trek because I thought she was so good in The Cage.
Yeah, we could have used a little bit more of her in Star Trek at some point.
Yeah, if only they found a bit role for her in the original series, and then maybe like a bigger role she could have in TNG, and then maybe she could have a lot of scenes with Odo in DS. No, that would be silly. I guess no. It's fine that she was just in The Cage.
And you know, I loved her voice, and if only they could have used that as the voice of the computer throughout almost all the series.
You know, if she had been the voice of the computer in, say, J.J. Abrams' Star Trek film, I think it would have made it a much better film, and I don't think people would have near the complaints they have about it.
All right. So we joke, of course, but yes, we love you, Majel, and it's sad that you're not here with us anymore. So happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
All right, Greg. Well, let's jump on into our news. And the first item this week, these images came out from CBS of the new packaging for Star Trek The Next Generation on DVD. Now, this was kind of a surprise because all this energy is going into the remastering and the Blu-rays. So why do you repackage The Next Generation and put it back out there again? I mean, I say put it back out there. It's already out there, but it's kind of like a relaunch on DVD.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, people love when they do re-release, you know, they make sure the originals are still out there. You know, this Blu-ray remastering set only comes with the new version. So I'm sure there are purists out there who want to see the episodes as they originally aired. And DVD is going to be the only place you can get that. They're not going to put that on the Blu-ray because it's VHS, you know, quality. At least, you know, it's no better than DVD quality. So for that, it's good. But it is a little odd that it's brand new packaging, a brand new release, you know, $35 for seasons 1 and 2, then $47 for the other seasons. It's a little odd considering it's the same set that's been out for years. And it's nowhere near as high quality as the remastered. You know, I there's going to be confusion. I think people are going to buy this thinking it's a DVD version of the remastering, which would look better.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, some people could possibly be confused by that. Now, do you have the box sets of The Next Generation?
I don't. I never did splurge. You know, they were always really expensive, like $80, $90.
Yeah. I have all of them, and with the packaging that they're doing now, of course, we haven't seen the new DVD packages, but I assume they'll probably be the same size as the Blu-ray packages that we're getting. You could actually do all 7 seasons in the size of 2 seasons in the original DVD packaging. So,
right. They're calling these sleek. They're saying it's sleek new packaging. Yeah. The image we do see that shows the cover shows them being pretty thin. Yeah, I remember the original ones being bulky, having like a sort of like a belt on them. Am I getting it confused?
They're
they were like these little pieces.
Yeah. They're these big boxes, and then you take another box out of the outer box, and then it's like a fan fold over and over and over. And then you can actually stretch it out on your desk and have all 7 discs in a line inside the box.
Oh, my goodness.
It was very elaborate packaging. It's extremely bulky. It was really cool at the time that it was done. But of course, these days with the, you know, more eco-conscious packaging and such, it's very, very outdated.
Right. You shouldn't have to do a barrel roll just to open your DVD case.
Which you do have to do in that case, because as it unfolds, it's the only way for you to escape, avoid being hit. I posted this on our Facebook page, and a lot of people liked the image, but the people who took the time to actually post a comment, it was almost universally negative to this move by CBS. One person said, what a waste of resources. One person said, and I think they're really, really missing the point, they said in a sarcastic voice, "Ooh, the packaging is different. I must rush out and buy it. We need new Trek, not recycled Trek." And I think you're really missing the point in that case. They're not expecting us to go buy it again because the packaging is different. They're just trying, like you said, Greg, they're making the original cuts available to those who want them. Not everyone has a Blu-ray player.
You know,
not everyone wants to buy the Blu-rays.
And here, because of the pricing, $35 for seasons 1 and 2, and coincidentally, I wonder, $47
right.
for the later seasons. You know, these are probably going to sell on Amazon, at Costco, Sam's, Walmart, for probably like $20. You know, $20 to $25, probably what you'll pay for these. And it actually makes The Next Generation accessible to a lot of people who really couldn't splurge for the Blu-rays up until this point.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, it's been silly how expensive it's been. And, you know, now with Netflix, as we talk about so much on this show, it's so easy. You know, $8 a month and you have access to all the Star Trek you want in standard def. But, you know, not everybody wants Netflix. Not everybody has an always-on internet connection, broadband.
Well, some people have streaming caps, right? You have
caps
on how much bandwidth you have for the month.
Right. You know, and it makes a lot more sense to have this. You know, obviously, if you already own it, there's no reason to buy it again.
Exactly.
I don't think Paramount expects anyone who owns the original DVDs, no one that owns the Blu-rays, to go out and buy this. This is for a different audience. This is for people who, you know, just want to buy a season at a time. They don't care to have the Blu-ray version for whatever reason. You know, it's good to have it available, and a re-release means it's not as hard to find. I mean, you can't walk into Target right now and buy those original sets. You know, maybe you can find them used, but you just can't find them.
Yeah, you have to order them from Amazon pretty much. Yeah, if you want them.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a good move. It doesn't cost the studio very much. They're not making any money, I think, at this point off of the existing release of TNG. And this
right.
is a way to get in the hands of some new people. The cover art's kind of interesting. It reminds me a bit of some of the recent Adobe Creative Suite packaging that's been done. It would certainly be eye-catching on the shelf. So, I don't know. It's a very inexpensive move for the studio, I think. And I don't think people should be quite so up in arms about it.
No, they really need not be. Yeah. And you talk about the cover art. I would love to see, you know, a poster made of these silhouette images. They're just really cool looking. I'm assuming it'll be the, you know, you'll be able to look at your iPhone or whatever and see the pictures right now. But go check out the whole banner, because these images of the 7 main cast characters, they're really striking, really cool. It's very different from what they've done with the Blu-ray, just conceptually. And it would make a really nice poster. Definitely not enough for me to go out and spend, you know, $40 per set, though, when I'm going to be buying these Blu-rays for $80 a piece.
Right. Yeah. I am looking forward to the 8th season set, which has a silhouette of Leffler for the spinoff series Leffler's Laws.
Was the 8th season an actual, was that TNG, or was it actually Leffler's Laws season 1?
It was Leffler's Law season 1. Yeah,
yeah.
It was a spinoff show. But you know, the connection is there. Wesley Crusher is a frequent guest star on the show. So, you know, they're going to put it out same style. It's kind of like a, you know, buy 3 seasons, get 1 free. You get the Leffler's Law bonus disc.
Right. It's too bad that show didn't last past the pilot episode. I was really excited to see all of the Leffler's Laws codified on screen.
All right, well, let's move on, Greg. Another thing that just came out is that La La Land Records has won 2 awards from the International Film Music Critics Association, and one of them is in the Best Archival Release of an Existing Score category for their beautiful set of the Star Trek The Motion Picture soundtrack that came out recently.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chris. I was just closing my eyes and listening to the overture from the motion picture again, as I do most mornings. I'm really appreciative for La La Land going out and archiving or getting, you know, remastering the motion picture. It's such a beautiful score. That they've won an award for it is phenomenal. And I would hope that an award like this is going to encourage them to make even more sets like this in the future.
I think they will. I mean, the other award they won is Film Music Record Label of the Year, and it's the 3rd straight year that they've done this. Now, we talk about them generally because of Star Trek, but if you go to their website, you can see it's just a vast amount of music that they are remastering. They're putting out these wonderful collector's edition, limited edition sets. I just got my DS9 one a few days ago. I had ordered, and it arrived, and it's the packaging is fantastic. The booklet is fantastic. And when you listen to it, I mean, you hear all this music that you know from the series because you've, you know, you hear it in the background as you're watching the show, and you're thinking, I would love to just be able to listen to this music. And having that, especially for DS9, because there hasn't been a lot of DS9 music released, you know, Emissary, The Visitor, I believe, Way of the Warrior, a little bit has come out. But this set has so much stuff on it. And so I'm just really glad that we have La La Land around.
Well, one thing I really like about those show sets is sometimes they include sound effects from the show, including like the bridge ambience. My question about the DS9 set, does it have promenade ambience? And if you listen really closely, can you hear Jake and Nog talking about girls?
You can. Yeah, that's on the fifth disc. It's the first half of the disc, as we talked about before, are all Lita squeeze. It's amazing how many different ways she can make noises. And the second half of the disc is just conversations of Jake and Nog, both on the promenade and also when they're sitting around near the docking ring watching the Bajoran women come off the transports.
Not creepy at all. And I'm sure there's a whole disc of Morn telling people stories, all those scenes that never made it onto the show itself.
Yeah, that is also there. So I'm still cool. Hoping at some point that I'm going to be able to get my hands on that complete TOS set that they released. It's just a big purchase at one time. I think the price per disc is perfectly reasonable, but there are a lot of discs, so
yes,
over $200. But I would absolutely love to have that.
Yeah, it makes you wish, and I'm sure La La Land Records wishes that show and movie soundtracks were less of a niche product. You know, they have to price things at a high level, so they can justify doing these big projects to remaster everything and put out the sets. They have to do these limited sets. They have to make them a fairly high price because it's not the sort of thing that a lot of people are just going to pick up while they're at Target.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So congratulations to La La Land.
Yeah.
Very well-deserved awards. Greg, we like to talk about StarTrek.com polls on here from time to time. And, of course, we always talk about how Voyager will win any poll, even, you know, what is your favorite flavor of ice cream? And it'll be like Leola root or something. Right in. The most recent poll, though, asked a question that I wanted to discuss with you because it's a topic that we kind of touch on often. And they asked, which doctor do you feel is the most skilled doctor of all the doctors on the Star Trek series?
And I was really glad to see that for once, Voyager didn't win the poll. As long as you assume that there were only two options, the EMH from Voyager or literally anyone else. Because literally anyone else got 49%, and the Doctor only got 41% of the vote. So that's clearly a loss. Voyager has the longstanding streak of winning all the StarTrek.com polls. It's over. Sorry, guys. It's time for the rest of the series combined to really show their strength.
Right. On an individual basis, of course, the EMH did win the poll with 41%. You know, this is one, though, where I don't have a problem with that, because if you think about it, the EMH has to be the most skilled doctor because he's programmed with the knowledge of all the other doctors.
Yes. I mean, even talking about Bashir is, you know, genetically modified. The doctor has, you know, bits of Bashir in him. Like, he's got all of these doctors from the past have all been placed inside of his programming. So whether he's treating a gunshot wound or he's treating an Andorian fight injury.
I've been attacked by an Andorian.
He knows what each of the doctors should have done that they didn't end up doing at the time. I don't know how you could contest this other than Phlox is just such an amazing guy. But as far as skilled, no, you got to go with the EMH.
Right, yeah. So I have no problem with that one. What's more interesting to me is the ranking of the other five doctors. Mm-hmm. Now, second place with 20% of the vote was Bones. I don't really have a problem with that. You know, I like the fact that Bones is always able to make do with what he has, and he can mm-hmm. find a solution to a problem. And I think that is what makes a good doctor, in addition to the obvious technical knowledge.
Well, I mean, I don't see Pulaski using Windex bottles and a blowtorch when doing medicine, whereas Bones will use pretty much any tool at his disposal.
Oh, that raises an interesting question. Do you think that MacGyver would have been a good doctor?
I think he would have been, yes. Just anything that comes through his door, he'll whip it up together, put some, you know, some chewing gum and a, you know, chewing gum wrapper and a paper clip and a blowtorch, and he'll solve, you know, that headache right away.
I think I saw him do that in one episode. Okay, number three was Bashir with 16% of the vote, Crusher with 14% of the vote, then Phlox with 7% of the vote, and then coming in last, Pulaski with 2% of the vote. Now, Greg, what do you think about Crusher having 14%, Pulaski having 2%, if we just keep it in the next generation here?
It's just ridiculous. I think people weren't paying close enough of attention. People have a thing against Pulaski that I understand, but she clearly is a very skilled doctor. She helped more people in that one season than Crusher's able to in the rest of the series. So I definitely think Pulaski's the doctor I would want as long as I'm completely unconscious. If I'm awake at all, sure, bring Crusher in. I'll take some diminished skill for the bedside manner.
Right. Like if you wake up after you've been kidnapped and you come back to the ship and you wake up and there's a face hovering right over you as you open your eyes, you'd prefer to have Beverly than Pulaski in that case, right?
I definitely would, yes. But I mean, out of all of these, I'd probably like Bashir's face hovering over me. I mean, this guy like cures whole, you know, like there's an epidemic on a planet and he'll just solve it in his spare time.
Right? That's the thing. Like, I mean, when I first read this, I was like, Bashir is third? Are you serious? But then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to take the EMH out of it because that's an obvious mm-hmm. first place. So you have Bones 20, Bashir 16, Crusher 14. Yeah, okay, I guess. But yeah, I mean, yeah, Bashir, he goes, like you said, he cures an entire epidemic on this planet. He cures the disease that Section 31 gave to the founders. I mean, it's really amazing the stuff that he does, and he does it without the benefit of, you know, being on a Federation starbase. He encounters things that many Federation doctors have never seen before that aren't going to be in the Starfleet medical database. So yeah. I think people don't give Dr. Bashir nearly enough credit.
Yeah, I think if I were to rank this, I would probably say the EMH, and then Bones, and then probably Bashir, then Phlox, then Pulaski, then Crusher. That's just off the top of my head, that sort of ranking. But Bashir clearly deserves to be near the top. And I think part of this weird ranking comes from the fact people had to only pick one. And I think most people just went with the EMH. And then the rest is just a smattering of personal opinion. You know, I like Crusher. I like Bones.
Well, that's what someone said in the comments. The question isn't who do you like the most? The question is who is the most skilled doctor? You know, Phlox, I know you're a big fan of Phlox. Phlox is a lot like Bones, right? He has to think on his feet, make do with what he has available to him at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Phlox has the osmotic eel and all of those things, the precursor to, you know, the little wavy device that the doctor uses. I feel like if Phlox, you know, if the doctor, the EMH, had to use the tools that Phlox had, he might have had a harder time mending so many things. Phlox had to work with the very little amount, not only that medicine had available in that time period, but even less because he was on, you know, a pre-Federation starship. What the things he's able to do, the lives he saves, is astonishing. And I hate that he's last on this list. I think that's very undeserved.
Right. Well, he's actually not last. Pulaski is last, but he's...
Oh, sorry.
But he's...
I was already discounting Pulaski. Like, Pulaski should obviously be higher. She's skilled.
But he's last...
But he only got 7% of the vote. That's silly.
Yeah, he's last of all the doctors who actually had a full run on the series.
Yes, right? Yeah. Exactly.
But I did like the one comment from Phil Moxley, who said, "Come on, folks. Good God, man. McCoy put Spock's brain back in his head."
Of course, he needed Spock's help. While Spock's brain was out of his head.
So really, really technically, Spock put his own brain back in his head, right?
He did, yes. McCoy was just the vessel. All right, Chris, well, I think it's about time to take a moment and have you tell us about something you like.
Well, Greg, you know what I like? You know what I really like? What I really like is our sponsor, Squarespace. And I'm really serious about that. They do make it possible for us to bring you the shows. But beyond that, you know, I've been using Squarespace for years. Even before I even started Trek FM, I've been using Squarespace. And it has made my life as a web designer and a content creator immensely easier.
Yeah, I love that it has a drag and drop interface. I like you can just grab like a picture and stick it right in there and just put it there. I can do HTML. You know, I think most of the listeners of the show can do at least some HTML, but the internet's gotten so complicated where you have to learn CSS and JavaScript and all this stuff just to make the website look the way you want it. Squarespace makes it so much easier.
You know, what's really cool, you mentioned the drag and drop in the images. Some of the technology behind Squarespace is really amazing. One thing that it has that is great for building richer websites and richer blogs and getting, when you get a site as large as Trek FM and you have so much content and you want to make sure people can find that content and you're able to assign an image thumbnail to every post, you're also able to specify whether a post is a featured post or not a featured post. And what's cool about the images in the image thumbnail is they have this little circle. It's called a focal point. And the system makes some decisions for you about how it displays the thumbnail image to represent your post based on what kind of template you're using. And you can actually drag this little circle around the image and set the focal point within Squarespace so it knows that when it serves up this thumbnail, it's going to shift the image up and down or left and right so that wherever you put that dot is the center of the image when it's shown as a thumbnail. And that's, it's really amazing to me. I've been doing this for so long and I'm so used to having to create images that are exactly the way I want them to display in every situation. And it saves me so much time because I can create one image and then I can actually tell the system just by dragging my finger on my trackpad where I want that focal point to be. And this has been just a great feature for me and a huge time saver. And then one thing, Greg, that you may want to do with all these images is build a store or at least sell some of your own artwork or crafts on your blog or your small business site. And to help you with that, Squarespace has launched just last week, actually, a new integrated commerce feature. Have you ever tried to, you know, set up PayPal or, you know, any kind of process?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many parts of this, you know. Setting up store pages is hard. And you just want it integrated with your website. I think that's the main thing everyone wants is not a whole other site that you send people to, but just a store link on your site that looks like your site, works like your site. And that seems to be what Squarespace is bringing.
What they've done here is they've actually worked out an agreement with Stripe, which is a merchant processing system that allows you to accept credit card payments on your website. And the really awesome thing about it is that it's completely integrated. So, you know, there's no confusing codes to enter and you can make your sales and the payments go directly into your bank account, which is a really big thing because some other systems make it kind of complicated for you to get your money out of the system into your bank account. So that's fantastic. And it's just a 30-second merchant account setup. Stripe,
I'm hearing wonderful things about. Friends of mine who are looking into doing their own stores have been looking at, you know, do I want to use PayPal or Google or Stripe or one of these others? And Stripe seems to be the place to go right now.
This is a fantastic new feature of Squarespace. Very simple pricing. There are no transaction fees imposed by Squarespace themselves. And Stripe has very favorable terms as well, which actually better than what I've seen with other services. And this is part of Squarespace's new business plan. So we've told you before, their pricing is very simple, $8, $16 for unlimited. And now they have the business plan, which is $24 a month. And it gives you everything that you get with unlimited. Plus, it gives you this incredible new commerce platform. So give it a try. Squarespace has a special offer for Trek FM listeners. If you go to squarespace.com/trek, you can try it free for 14 days. There's absolutely no obligation on your part. You know, they don't ask you for a credit card. You just go sign up. You get access for 14 days to every feature in Squarespace. You can build a site. You can take it for a spin yourself. And we promise you that you'll love it and you'll want to sign up. And when you do sign up, you can use offer code TREK2. That's TREK2 because this is February now. And that'll get you 10% off of your lifetime purchase with Squarespace. So go check them out. Squarespace.com/TREK and use offer code TREK2 and you'll be supporting Trek FM, helping us bring this programming to you and supporting our sponsor at the same time. As we move into movie news and rumors, Greg, you showed me a really cool poster yesterday.
Yeah, this is really cool. It's by a guy who goes by Cakes Comics on Twitter. That's with an underscore. But he's actually Matt Ferguson in England. And he made this poster for Into Darkness that is one of the most striking film posters I've ever seen. I'm really amazed by it. You may have seen it, our listeners. It's got Cumberbatch's gigantic head at the top with the words, "Shall we begin?" And then there's the Enterprise, and of course she's on fire, because what else is going to happen with the Enterprise in a JJ film? And I mean, it's the striking image that one would hope the film can live up to. It's the sort of poster they used to come out with where it shows you something so powerful that it makes you want to go see the film.
It is a really cool design, and I think I told you that it's too bad that the studio won't do anything remotely like this for the actual poster. It's very artistic. I would love to see a finished product. I mean, I think clearly here he used the photo of Cumberbatch from, was it Empire? I think.
Right. It looks like the Empire picture, which, I mean, it's a great picture and he's done great work with it, you know, rasterizing it, making it really dark and powerful at the top. But yeah, if it were original artwork, that would make it even more amazing. And if Paramount, Paramount retweeted this image, it really got some traction this week. And obviously, the folks at Paramount who are promoting the film like this and think it's really cool. But yeah, I don't think it's the sort of thing they would actually do. I'm so sick of the actual Into Darkness poster. As powerful as it was when I first saw it, I'm now just like, it's just so. It's really bland looking at this point.
Well, and we've talked about on here before how derivative it is of so many other posters in recent years, whereas this one is, you know, it's very artistic. It's the kind of thing that, if you were in a theater and you walked by and you weren't a Star Trek fan, you didn't know anything about Star Trek, but you're just walking through the theater to go see another movie and you see this on the wall, it's going to catch your eye. You're going to go, what is that? And, you know, if this were, I love the design concept, and certainly it looks beautiful here just with what Matt has had to work with. If he then took this a step further, and if this were completely original illustration, this would be a fantastic poster that I would pay $80 for to hang on my wall.
Well, I mean, Matt actually worked on, he made the Avengers poster. If he bought the Super Deluxe 3D edition of the Avengers and then sent off for the poster with $3.99 shipping handling. I don't know how many people did this. I did this. And the poster that they send you is actually one that he made. So he's clearly well known, you know, in these circles. Paramount knows about him. I'm hoping, really hoping, they've gotten in touch with him and are going to have him make at least some sort of alternate poster that they can sell through StarTrek.com. Something more original that's, you know, maybe with a little bit more money on his hands, he could make something even better. I really hope that happens. This is something I'd love to see on my wall.
Yeah, or make it the, when they release the Blu-rays, you know, they always do a special, like a 3-disc set. You know, make this the cover of the deluxe edition. So everyone, check out the link we'll put in the show notes or tap your screen here and go check this out. And, you know, send a message, send a tweet to Paramount, send a tweet to StarTrek.com official or to JJ or whoever and tell them you like this because it's great work here by Matt Ferguson.
Yeah, very, very cool. I've been in touch with him over Facebook, and I've just been telling him how amazed I am. And I see other people doing that as well. So hopefully this will keep gaining traction.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the topic of the movie, there was another featurette that was released with just a couple of more items from JJ here. It was released last Monday, and it's scenes from the movie mixed with some interview footage with JJ where he tells us a few things about the film, I guess largely things we've already heard before.
Yeah, I mean, it's still not anything new. We're still waiting for that new trailer, like the actual official film trailer that we should be seeing in the next couple weeks. I don't know what the next big film release is. That's really what I'm waiting for. You know, they're just sending us scraps right now. Stuff like, you know, Zoe Saldana saying, this is the sort of film that 3D is made for. I don't know what that means. I'm sorry.
You know, I was going to say at the beginning of the show, I'm expecting at the Oscars tomorrow night that Star Trek Into Darkness is going to win a preemptive Oscar for Best Rumor Mill for an upcoming film.
Yes, it definitely is. Oh, man. And things have still been going on this week. People are saying that maybe Peter Weller is playing Carol Marcus's father.
Yeah.
And that comes from nothing other than pure speculation.
Well, no, that
people.
Doesn't come from nothing. That comes from the comic.
Well, yes, but you're reading the comic and you're like, oh, well, there's Alex Marcus. Well, maybe that's Peter Weller. But well, you know, I've heard people say maybe Peter Weller's playing Robert April. Maybe Peter Weller's playing Khan. Maybe Peter Weller's playing Pike, who damaged after radiation experiments.
I think, though, that, you know, saying Peter Weller is maybe playing Khan, which is something we have said quite a few times as well, made some sense until the most recent comic came out. And then it was when it was revealed that Robert April's first officer was Alex Marcus, then you thought, oh, okay, well, Carol Marcus is in the movie and we don't know who Peter Weller's playing. So yeah, it makes a bit more sense.
It makes a bit more sense. I'm amazed that we're 3 months out. And we still don't really have a good idea. You know, 3 months out from a Star Wars film, and we've pieced together the entire plot.
Right.
People, I mean, just not even from the spoilers, but just from what's been released, we already know everything that's going to happen.
Well, tell me this, Greg. Are you surprised to hear this information from J.J. Abrams? Now, in the featurette, he says there are a lot of characters that people are anticipating seeing. Kirk and Spock, Bones, Scotty, Uhura, Chekhov, and Sulu.
All of them. Wow. I mean, he somehow didn't mention Kienzer. Is this a sign that he's cut Kienzer from the film?
I think Kienzer may be on the cutting room floor.
Oh, man. That's going to be rough.
He says that the action in this movie is light years beyond what we did in the first movie, you know, which is great. And then Zachary Quinto says that it was pretty magical to see what they could create this time. It's stunningly beautiful. I don't know if he was talking about Zoe or not, because she is stunningly beautiful.
Oh, she certainly is. I do wonder if they've had the actors in to watch a more completed cut. I'm assuming they've got to be giving the film to Giacchino soon, at least a version without the effects done, so he can get the music. I mean, the music has to be at least in progress right now. So it is good to hear that the actors are saying positive things about it, but I mean, obviously it's a it's film promotion and that's built in to what you have to do when you're promoting a film. I'm expecting it to be beautiful, though. I mean, what we have seen looks really amazing.
Well, the last item that we have today is, again, about JJ, and it comes from an interview with MTV. And there were a couple of revelations in here. One of them is the confirmation that Klingons are in the movie. Now, I was really surprised to hear this because I thought this had been pretty much confirmed a long time ago.
I thought it had. I mean, Klingons were in the first film, but they were cut at the last minute. You can sort of see them in the background of one shot during the mind meld. But yeah, no, we knew Klingons were going to be in this, not only from, you know, I mean, there was a Klingon in the trailer. I'm pretty sure at least we could assume it was a Klingon. There's a Klingon on the cover of Into Darkness or Countdown to Darkness number 4. I thought there had been plenty of confirmation of Klingons.
I guess until JJ actually says it himself, the words come out of his mouth, it's not actually confirmed. But yeah, we will.
I'm looking forward to the day after release where we've all seen the film, but we're still not sure. Was that the actual film? Or was that just something that they released to throw us off the trail?
Right. The real film comes out next week. I think the big question is just, will we see the Klingons without their helmets on?
Right, right. And I would assume we are. Again, I thought there was something we heard a few weeks ago where most of the Klingons are not going to have their helmets off, but a couple of them will take off their helmets.
I remember hearing that, yeah.
Yeah. At the very least, we have those Creo figures where you can take the helmet on and off as much as you want. It's fine.
Right. But not until release day of the movie, remember. It's sealed until then.
That's right. Which I did want to mention, we've talked in the past about, well, of course, May 17th is the official film's release. But there was that special secret presale for IMAX screenings on May 15th, where if you had the official app, you could buy advance tickets. But now it appears that it's just fully, there's an IMAX release on the 15th that anyone can buy tickets. You don't even have to be in the app. You can just buy tickets to it. I don't know if maybe the app wasn't as popular as they thought, and so they had to release it to a wider public. I'm not sure. But at this point, you should still be able to get tickets to those advanced screenings on the 15th.
That sounds quite likely. Yeah, not enough people pre-ordered through there.
Yeah. I was wondering, am I going to be like one of five people in the theater watching it early? But if they're opening it to a wider audience, no, I'm sure they'll fill every one of those seats.
Yeah. Oh, definitely they will. So the other revelation here, Greg, was about Carol Marcus. Now, what did JJ have to say about Carol Marcus in the film?
He says she's part of the adventure and her role is important and she wouldn't be in the movie otherwise. So,
well, thanks,
I guess
JJ.
That's good to know. Good to know she's not just a throwaway character, I suppose. I assume she was important. I mean, it's a film. They don't really have much time for extra stuff.
I know. I got to tell you, the answers that we get in these interviews just continue to leave me shaking my head. And not that JJ says them, because I completely understand why he says them. I mean, he's keeping us on our toes. He's keeping the rumor mill going. It's actually the news reporters and how they will make entire stories out of something like, Carol Marcus is important. That's why she's in the movie.
Right. Carol Marcus, central to plot. Is she actually Khan in disguise? More at 11.
That would be cool because, you know, he did Mission Impossible 3, right? So maybe she's going to rip the mask off and it's Khan underneath.
I'm hoping she rips the mask off and she's actually Elizabeth Daner.
Judge a man by the color of his skin. You can't read his cool by the scruff on his chin. Don't know what makes him tick by the Rolex on his wrist. But you can't judge a man. Yeah. I don't wanna be his
Does data have rights? That is the question raised in the second season episode, The Measure of a Man. This courtroom drama has become one of Star Trek's most famous stories, and it was recently made even better with the addition of 13 minutes of footage that was cut from the original. So today we're going to talk about The Measure of a Man, and to help us do that, we have back with us, friend of the show, and the latest incarnation of Dr. McCoy, it's Larry Nemechek. Hello, Larry. How are you?
That's pretty good, Larry. I'm impressed.
did they make you transport aboard, or did they send a shuttlecraft for you there, Bones?
Right. No, I always insist on shuttles until we get rid of those sparkly things. I don't know what the hell I'm talking. We're just wasting time for now.
Start talking about Andorian shingles. I'll be right at home.
Yeah. I didn't do the party impersonation of McCoy. When you're actually learning lines and acting, it kind of... there were times when I would really try to... whenever I had a couple of times about, I didn't have a he's dead, Jim line, but there was one part I did get to say he's dying. It just came out, it just channeled, it just, he's dying. Yeah.
So for those who don't know yet, Larry, you are playing Dr. McCoy in the new Star Trek Continues.
Yes. On about 3 weeks' notice, I got this unbelievable call to come in and do it. And right in the middle of the secret project, I still can't talk about for another 2 or 3 months. But so it was kind of crammed. And it was the hardest working fun I've done in years, probably, because I hadn't acted on camera in a long time. So I had to get technique back up and learn lines and work at night. And it was crazy. But it was a wonderful group and incredible stuff. And if you see the pictures online, my sites or at the Star Trek Continues sites and Facebook page. It's incredible. And it's a wonderful group of people and professionals. And if they weren't professionals, they're professionals in training. was that funny? Oh, no. Seriously, it was, anyway, it was a great group. And, you know, Grant Imahara played Sulu and Chris Doohan plays his dad's role, Scotty.
Looking forward to that when it comes incredible. Out. We'll see Larry on the screen.
Me too. I'm looking forward to them updating the publicity shot. So if anybody goes to the site, it still has a guy named Chuck Huber playing McCoy.
That is not you.
That's confusing. It's not me. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing what happens when they get you under those TOS lights. It just transforms everything.
It does. It makes you look like you're clean shaven. It makes you look like your hair's darker. It's most of the time you look like you have less poundage. So anyway.
All right. So The Measure of a Man. Now, Greg, you have been chomping at the bit to do this ever since it was shown in the theater. But because of scheduling the past couple of times around with TNG, our TNG show, we haven't gotten to it. So here we are today. So, Greg, why don't you lead us into this discussion?
Chomping and stomping.
Yeah, ever since I was, you know, crying in the theater openly, I think is what you meant to say. They showed this about hour-long cut of the show, and I had forgotten, I think, how good TNG was, because all I'd seen, you know, I'd seen the first season because of the Blu-ray set, been watching so much of that, and I've been watching so much DS9 and Enterprise, I was like, oh, well, TNG's that other show. But then I watched this, and I was like, oh yeah, TNG, this is a really, really good show. And for once, like, adding scenes makes it better and not just drag on and be boring.
Yeah, that's the thing, yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to talking about it.
Yeah, this is TNG was why there was a DS9 in Enterprise.
I knew as soon as you said that, Larry was going to jump. Larry is shocked. He's like, what?
Oh, it's not that I forgot that TNG was a great show, but, you know, it's easy to have fun with TNG, especially in the first season, making jokes about, you know, Wesley's baseball bat. But when
I don't even think about the first season. Well, I mean, it's there, but it's like, it's the baby steps that they all supposedly got, except for...
And we've all seen TNG so many times. Yeah, every episode so many times. Yeah. It's so familiar to us.
Well, it was the shock of seeing new footage, like on the big screen. I was seeing new Star Trek for the first time, you know, discounting the JJ film, but for the first time in like, 10 years. So that was a big shock as well.
Yeah.
Let's not push it. You mean like since Enterprise, right? So let's just say 8 years or something. Okay, let's not race the clock up too much. The chronometer's up. No, you felt like being a Who fan, getting to see a new episode of you know, found in a vault in Australia or something somewhere that they've uncovered. So, yeah, that was kind of amazing. And it was weird that she had, and it was, you know, obviously it was all character stuff because that's what gets cut in time first. And the scene with Pulaski in the party was kind of funky.
That scene was kind of funky, but I agree that most of the footage in here was, it made the episode better. I had not watched this episode in several years, and then I went back to watch it a few times to get ready for this, and I started with the extended cut. And I felt like, wait a minute, which footage has been put in and which footage hasn't, because it all flowed so well, and it all felt like it was needed for the story. And so it was that one case where it felt like it must have been really painful for them to have to remove, you know, figure out what they can take out to get it down to 45 minutes.
Well, there's the scene where Data gives Geordi the pipe.
Yes.
The Sherlock Holmes pipe. And it feels like, well, A, such great continuity. I mean, they'd just done Elementary, My Dear Data.
Right.
For this to be in the script, I don't know if Melinda had written it into the script originally, or she was just looking for, like, oh, I need something, you know, something for him to give to Geordi. And they wrote it in last minute after they'd done Elementary. Either way, great having that continuity in there. And it's this really touching moment, and it feels so necessary to the plot to have it go from, well, you know, the only option is he quits, to, well, then he's packing his bags. Like, it's this so necessary scene. I can't believe it wasn't there originally.
Yeah. And there are a lot of scenes like that in here, but 13 minutes is a huge amount. You know, I edit things where I have to cut something down to, like, it's a, you know, a short promotional thing. I have to cut it down to 3 minutes, but I have like 5 minutes of footage that I don't want to put in. And that's difficult. And to get 13 out, I don't know how you would do it.
Well, it's really not that rare a thing. I mean, I remember in the time when I was out fairly hands-on around, not hands-on, but around a lot and episodes having to be cut, and a lot of directors, just to give choices to the editors, would do, you know, especially as they went on. This is early in the modern, you know, restoration. So in the second, not only is it the second year TNG, but it's the second year out of 18 that they'd be around. And by the time they got into DS9 and Voyager and all that, the directors, especially on DS9, would take like huge, if they were paying all those extras, you know, if they had a lot of money in something, they'd like do a sweeping intro shot of like the promenade with all the extras and then finally come to rest on booth. And that was all stuff they could cut if they needed to. You know, they could cut into it anywhere. So this was 13 over. It was, I remember lots of times when they got to cut 10, 15
yeah,
minutes.
But outside. That kind of footage is not integral to the story, though. That's kind of like filler.
Right, right.
It's almost like, it's like space B-roll that you have going there.
And they, when they try to write to a page length. But I think if you listen to the comment, listen to Melinda's commentary.
Yeah, I did.
Because she's been, it's really cool that they got her, because she's been really, she had such a bad taste in her mouth when everything turned around in the third season. And Michael Piller gets all the kudos of making it happen, lifting the writing staff up and bringing some stability to it. Everybody who was there, it was a hard wrenching turn for everybody after Maury Hurley left, of Michael's style versus his in a lot of ways. And, you know, there's pluses in Tracy Torme was the same way. And, it's not that Michael's a bad person. He obviously attracted a lot of new people and, you know, came on, but it's almost like having your own team versus the new boss's team, the old guys. You know, it's just things. It's a workplace then. It's not Star Trek. But just so to have her back and talking about the episode on that, which is also cool. But some of the things she was talking about, I think they wrote, you're talking about the pipe. I went through the script because all those scenes are in the final draft that they have on the archive. So, you know, it was a last minute trim, and they don't bother to go back a lot of times, and it's a luxury to go back and fix the scripts. And now in hindsight, I'm glad they don't. But the pipe was written in, and yeah, it was like they finally had dredged up enough continuity. There was enough backstory on people starting to finally fill in on the second season that they could, you know, they could have little moments like that where they barely had the pipe. And, you know, and so by the time of the end of the run, they've got all the stuff that they could quarters, and it was, oh, look, there's his Tasha hologram box, and there's his pipe, and there's his violin, and, you know, everything else that came along with it.
It's too bad they didn't bring Spot into the courtroom. Did he have Spot at this point?
Oh, that would have been good if he'd put Spot into his little gym bag as well.
Yeah.
And then Spot was just in there the whole time until Picard finally opens
like a rabbit in the hat.
Picard finally opens it. Yes.
He goes to the transporter room. He's about to leave the ship, and they open the bag, and they go, "What is this?" And he's like, "Alf,"
no,
and he's like,
"No,
Spot,
no,
how did you get in there? Bad boy, bad boy."
I was thinking, rabbit out of a hat, but no, I can just sit there in the middle of the court, and it's very serious, very serious, and Picard goes, "Ah." It says, "Now look who's let the cat out of the bag." I mean, you know, it was really bad.
Oh, goodness.
That would have been on the other side of the court.
Right. Little moments, I mean, I can understand they were cut, but they're really great for character stuff. I'm thinking especially of Nakamura and Picard talking about being on the Reliant together. I mean, talk about tying together continuity, you know, putting them on a ship we've already seen, explain that they have a past together.
But what did you think about Nakamura overall, though? I felt like Nakamura was a little bit too... some of that I'm glad was trimmed down a little
slap
bit.
Happy.
Those, him running around the ship and coming on the bridge, and he's like, "I'm the little admiral." And Nakamura, this guy...
Short and stout, here is my hand.
This guy has got to be a legend at the Starfleet School of Fashion, because he's rocking that admiral's uniform.
We've seen a lot
of, you know, enhancements that the admirals do to their uniforms. Boy, he's got the bling going on.
He really does. I'm trying to figure out, did you guys go back and watch the not extended edition? Because I'm trying to remember how much Nakamura there was. It feels like so much of his scenes were cut out. Even the one scene where he says Nakamura out at the end, where he's basically just said, "I don't care, make it happen." That wasn't even in the original cut.
They cut it. Well, it's like basically he like, "Hi, I'm gonna walk a big circle around your bridge and then leave."
Exactly.
Okay, bye. You know, I always thought that scene was like, this is a big scene to give him a lot of message, and so, you know, like Maddox can shoot longing looks over Data, and
it is that great shot that it's sort of like a dolly around Data, and they're all in the background, and you've got looks from everyone at everyone. I love that one shot, but that must be Nakamura's only moment in the original cut.
Yeah.
He walks in on them in the tape. Everybody piles out of that turtleneck car like clowns out of a clown car.
They just like that girl in the club, and there's that creeper across the room that's like staring at her, and Data's really uncomfortable, and Maddox is back there in the back giving him the eyes.
And Riker's really uncomfortable because he wants the girl for himself.
And I thought we'd cut away to the shot of the Ferris wheel and the carousel on the view screen, you know, with the carnage. Yeah,
exactly.
And Julia Roberts in here.
Right. Nakamura is a weird character. I mean, I don't know what sort of admiral this guy is. He doesn't care to be involved in the situation. It's like he didn't give it a second thought. And I don't know if it's Melinda talking about just bureaucracy. Like sometimes an order just comes down from the top, and no one gave it much thought until it gets to the people who were involved. That's kind of the sense I get.
Well, that's because if this is only season two, Greg. They're not living legends yet. They're only good officers.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just another good officer. Stuff happens.
I got that impression too, though, because he tells Picard that, well, you know, it's just a transfer order like any other transfer order. Big deal.
Yeah,
he doesn't care at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it just feels like Maddox...
Didn't they tell you it costs an arm and a leg to wear that uniform?
Right. Yeah. I just feel like they could have... I mean, Maddox kind of has no heart, so I understand from him... I feel like they could have broken this to Picard and Data a little bit easier. Maddox could have made his life a little bit easier by saying, "Look, we know this is difficult, but this is, you know, this is the plan. We'd like Data to come," but just dropping it on him like a ton of bricks, like, "Oh yeah, Maddox is gonna rip open your lieutenant commander there. Have a good day."
I'm sorry, Greg, but wussy Starfleet's in the next room. I mean, this is a real man Starfleet here, and we drop stuff on a ton of bricks on you, whether you like it or not. No, I know it serves the but as Maddox, and I liked what Melinda says too. I got this. I mean, Mike Akuda was asking a couple of questions, I guess, to clarify for people listening, for all the new fans. But I had no problems understanding throughout the whole show that he wasn't putting on an act or being self-serving. He since Maddox sincerely thought Data was a machine. And his little slip at the end, where he calls him a he and she catches him on it, was supposed to be a telling moment. Yeah. I didn't, you know.
Yeah,
see
I think.
Which is why it makes it, you know, and then in Data's day and later on when he does show that he kept up in touch with him and writes him a letter, it is a telling evolution of, and a sign of Data, you know, not having hard feelings. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'll work with you anytime, guy, if you just promise not to kill me. You know, I'd be happy to.
I think some of that, Greg, that feeling that you have too, is us watching Next Generation for so many years and coming to know Data as he evolved over time. And when we go back now and we watch that, maybe we're a bit surprised that someone like Maddox mm-hmm. would have that reaction, that view of Data. But at this point in the Next Generation, you know, Data was still very much portrayed as this machine and this android. And, you know, is he really a person or is he, you remember Riker's reaction to him in Encounter at Farpoint. So mm-hmm. it made more sense at the yeah. time. And looking back now, it's colored a little bit.
Well, that's what I mean, I was being facetious, but that's what I meant by living legend yeah. versus, yeah. you know, just a good officer.
Sure.
Well, I take Maddox at his word that he is sincerely, he feels this way. You know, he thinks I can make this race of androids and it'll be good for everyone. And step, you know, one at this point is disassemble Data. He's not doing it for evil purposes. He's not, he's not trying to kill Data. He just doesn't see Data as anything more than what he is. I do, the one thing they cut that kind of puts Maddox in the villain category is when he does crash the party, crashes the goodbye party. Yeah. I feel like he should have had a drink in his hand. You know what, Data? The thing you ought to do next.
With his tie unraveled or something.
You ought to be a carnival act. That's what I think. Yeah.
And they actually let Riker touch another human being, like roughly. That wasn't an alien, you know, villain. It was like, that was so, when I was watching that scene again, the extended, and he actually runs over and says, yeah, but nobody invited you. Yeah. I don't remember inviting you. And he grabs him and kind of shoves him out the door. I was like, wow, this is like, you know, pre-DS9 Star Trek. Wow, it's nobody's shoving anybody around, and they're not under alien influence. They're all supposed to.
And the one thing Worf got to do in this episode, which sort of edge past Wesley, that's his one thing. But Picard's like, no, Worf, I've got this one.
And then look longingly over Wesley's shoulder as he reads the Klingon book.
Oh yes,
did you see that? He's like, it's like they gave a little, and Melinda's saying, well, I was glad to give Wesley something like quasi-positive in this show. It's like, well, one thing, but yeah, that was the token, you know, group scene. And they cut, and then, and it's really Troy's main scene too, if you think about it. And they cut half of it. You know, she's in the party.
Right.
Well, I like the line in there where Riker asks Troy, you know, what do you feel from Data? And she says, well, I don't feel anything from Data. And then Troy's like, but it's not unusual, you know. There are a lot of people, a lot of life forms for whom I can't read anything.
Many minds.
And we're like, yeah, really? I've seen the show. I know.
Right. Very often I can't do anything at all when presented with a person that I'm supposed to be helping out by reading their mind. I just, nothing at all comes to me. I mean, usually I'm just making it up.
I'm lucky to be still treading these boards after I was not in four shows the first season.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then I got pregnant and they had to keep me.
But talking about Maddox here, there's one thing on the commentary where Mike asks Melinda, why couldn't Maddox just, you know, do a backup of Data's memory?
Yeah.
And but Mike says, I'm going to ask you the big geek question here. And she says it's because, you know, she didn't really know how computers worked then. You know, she's just writing a drama. And so she says her answer now is that Data is so advanced, so complex, you know, that they couldn't figure out a way to do it.
Well, it's answered in the show. You know, they talk about the ineffable qualities that, you know, just because you make a copy doesn't mean you've kept
yeah,
all of the little connected
it is,
bits.
As you go along, they were talking about at the moment when they first start talking about the fact that they need to take him to the starbase and they need to.
Right.
Basically take him apart and download his memory. You know, he should have like a USB port on his back, like right near the off switch where you could just plug, you know, like a little thumb drive in.
Don't you remember in Crisis or Disaster, where they just like stuck the plug? It was late, you know, it was the early 90s.
Connectors were much bigger.
You had to have hoses of, the late, great Senator Ted from Alaska and his, it's a series of tubes. In the 21st century, the internet was a series of tubes and they plugged into your Android head.
Right. And of course, it wasn't a European ship or they would have been required to use the mini plug in his head.
Yes. Right. Well, if it was from the original series, it would have been one of those little cards. Everyone carries like 20 of these little square cards with them everywhere. They don't ever put them anywhere. They just have them. They shuffle them during meetings.
They have the slots, Greg.
Yes.
There's the tape slots everywhere. They're cool. They can Decker gets to play Captain Queeg and Humphrey Bogart with his metal balls with him in Doomsday. We can talk about Doomsday.
I just hope that Data has slots in his back that you can just put these little tapes in there too.
Ah. And hit different format slots. Yes. Like here's the
exactly.
Here's the SD card slot. He's got a compact flash.
Well, she got back to something about Data being a programming and did soon create a program. I love how they would come up with words, especially in the early years, the technobabble, a heuristic algorithm and a heuristic matrix and all of that. But whether, he actually did learn from, and whether he was designed to learn, start off as a series of programming and be a product greater than the sum of his parts. Because here's what's always got me about Data once they got into the backstory and nailed everything down. He was found in like 2338 or something by the Tripoli, okay? So people run around like, it's Data and we're just meeting you. And okay, that's fine on one hand. But he's still on his hunt for humanity, right? His personal quest to whistle. And I mean, Melinda wrote a scene where he learned to swim in this and they got changed to the poker scene, which was kind of cool. Although you could tell her rookiness because they would never do a scene of, you have to put a swimming pool and, like they said, water and makeup and.
Yeah.
But my point is, what I've always wondered about Data is, what happened to him? He has one episode where he runs through, I went through the academy 4 years, and I went to graduate school and training and command training, and I had, which is fine. But what the subtext to that is, did he, just acquire humanity osmosis for 30 years and then finally hit critical mass in 2364 when he met all these wonderful people on D? For 30 years, he didn't pick anything up along the way.
You didn't hear the stories, Larry? When he was at the academy, he was always partying over at the Vulcan compound.
He didn't pick the bad friends. He picked the boring friends. That's what.
Seriously, the sense I got...
That's always got me, seriously.
The sense is I got, it was like Odo's early days, where he was being pushed and prodded, and they were examining him for so long, and he was like saying, look guys, I'd really like to go to the academy now, if you don't mind, and they just kept telling him, oh no, don't worry, next season, you just got to help us out this time, then you can go to the academy next year.
But it's a whole nother year.
And Maddox still, at the end of it, was voting against him actually going to the academy, but he finally got his way. So I feel like he was learning from that panel of doctors through that time. He was reading all he could. He was reading the Shakespeare, reading all the stories. But it was until he actually got on a starship. I could see him not really getting the full gamut of humanity until he met our cast of characters. Before that, it was just assimilating, raw knowledge.
The FGH. The Fago. The full gamut of humanity. Okay.
So what do you guys think about another point that Mike makes in the commentary where he says that his reading of Data was always that Data had emotion but didn't realize he had emotion?
I never heard it put that way because Data clearly, like he says, he clearly, the corners of his mouth curl up. I think that was partly Brent's sanity as an actor trying to find something to cling on to, no pun intended. I mean, something to get his, he can't chew whole curtains of scenery, but they would throw him little scraps of duct tape, and that was what he had to chew on. That was what he could do. And since the palette of Data was such a tiny little thing regarding emotions, that any little movement was a big thing. It resonated with contrast. So when you'd see his lip kind of curl up or he'd go, and do the head quirk, you knew it was a little editorial comment.
And right.
If that's what Mike is calling about having an emotion and letting it out, then I guess you could call it that.
Yeah, I think it's the question of, was Data programmed by Soong to have emotion, and somehow that had, like, it was in the programming. I know later they did the whole emotion chip and everything, but was it in the programming somehow, and the programming had to grow itself, and Data had to kind of learn that this thing that is happening here is emotion, and learn how to channel that?
Well, the emotion chip was, he was built to take it. He just never got a chance to give it to him,
right,
because, you know, they were run off by the crystalline,
yeah,
the CE ran them off. So it was intended to go into him, because when he did finally get his hands on him, he was like, okay, here, damn it, here's the hatch, bang, pop it in, bang, go. Finally, 20 years later, okay. But the question kind of is backed up is, did the assembly, again, did he wind up being more than the sum of his parts emotionally,
right,
before the chip came along and did it with technology?
Yes.
Did that happen intentionally, or did it happen accidentally, to where if the emotion chip had never come along and he had just gone on this way for another 20 or 30 years, and somebody remembered to tell Brent that he had an aging program, or a youth program where he wouldn't have to age, or that he had an aging program and he would age with everybody.
Right.
So he could play him another 20 or 30 years on TV. If he had kept, you know, the rate of, if the critical mass had hit where you wouldn't need the technology crutch of a chip, that it actually, the programming would have led to something on its,
yeah,
own.
I think that's the question.
And I totally go with that. I think Data's learning as he goes. He's, you know, what is emotion, but, you know, having a personal response to situations. And clearly Data does more than just crunch the numbers and respond. He talks about my life, my wants, my rights. He clearly has an emotional response to things. It's just a matter of, you know, how much is he aware of that, and how much is it controlling him? You know, I think what the emotion chip did was overload him. You know, we see in Generations, especially First Contact, where he starts feeling afraid. I don't know. It would have taken a long time for this Data to just feel afraid. But things like longing, things like trust and friendship and even love, I think he's really, really getting there even at this point.
Well, and when they ask him, why do you have these medals? Why do you have the little, you know, babe you banged hologram? Why do you have this? And he's like, I just want them. You know, it's like he's struggling for the word. God, we've gotten awful serious on here. But anyway, he's struggling for the words and doesn't have the vocabulary. The programming hasn't multi-layered over it enough to make him have any kind of ease of talking about it. But he's clearly struggling and has the root, you know, grunting,
right,
inclination to go that,
right,
way when he's asked,
yeah,
about it.
I love his little moments of, you know, silent protestation. You know, we talked about a couple weeks back Sisko and how vulnerable he was in Far Beyond the Stars. And he didn't get all, you know, whatever we call Spock, shouty pants. He doesn't get like shouty in these moments. He just sort of has so much emotion, he doesn't know what to do with it. And Data has that in the scene with Picard where he's talking about, it's where he's talking about the visor. And he says, you know, why isn't everyone required to get their eyes replaced with Geordi's visor? And then Picard can't answer it. You can tell that Data has a lot of emotional feelings about this. And I love that he doesn't get angry. He just states his case very clearly. It's like an example of what we should do when we're in a situation where we disagree with what's,
yes,
happening. You know, yelling doesn't solve anything. And a lot of times people forget that. And even on Star Trek, people forget that. Data is a great example of just state your case, be calm, give people a chance to, you know, get their head around things.
Yeah. I was thinking about some of the other scenes that were cut too. The whole fencing thing was kind of interesting.
That was really interesting.
And I'd forgotten that so much of it was gone. And in the commentary, they're saying something about, well, so they, you know, she'd wanted to be Riker and Picard fencing and personifying, you know, subtext. Oh, look, they're fencing as a subtext, so they're going to be fencing in court.
Yeah.
How cool is that? I almost think it was strong. It wasn't stronger, but I almost think it wasn't as on the nose to not have him be the fencing opponent.
You know what would have been a lot stronger? Was the original concept where Riker comes in the room and Picard is fighting an Andorian.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
With a LARPA? With an Ambo Jitsu rod. Yes. That's what it needed to be. Yeah. Well, no, so I was, you know, I just thought I'd go to see the sun. So they, it was kind of interesting where she said, I don't know who that guy was. So well, just so everybody knows out there, the guy's name was Victor Paul.
He was Vincent. So now we know.
Because
Victor
the minute
Paul.
I watched it, yeah. Well, that's the actors, or the guy. What he really was probably was a fencing expert. But why they probably didn't have them fencing each other was they didn't have time to give Riker fence. And I'm sure that, I mean, to give Jonathan some fencing instruction, because I know that, as she says, Patrick probably had some fencing in his background.
Probably. Well, Larry, you know that Picard has his own personal fencing officer who's always on standby duty just for when Picard wants to fence.
But that's the sense I get.
All rank has its privilege.
He's just always, he's on call anytime. Sort of like the guy Riker has. You talk about Amber Jitsu. I think Riker can just go down to, you know, the Amber Jitsu match, and he's got this guy, and he fights with him all the time. Maybe the scene would have been stronger if they had both been fighting, you know, different people, and they were just doing this whole thing over the intercom. Cut between the Amber Jitsu and the fencing, back and forth, back and forth.
Tapping awesome. Of, yeah.
Have some cool camera cuts going back and forth.
Exactly.
Yes, that would have been awesome.
No, I could just see you see a scene in Starbase someplace, and the Enterprise is docked, and you're seeing some below decks kind of people over on the corner of the bar, and a guy walks in, and somebody says, hey, Ensign Chen, I haven't seen you in a while. What are you doing these days? Oh, haven't you heard? I'm the AJO on the Enterprise. You are? Yeah, I'm the Ambo Jitsu officer. Oh, okay.
That explains the outfit you're always wearing.
Yeah. That orange, which doesn't go with anything.
Now, we do get a scene similar to what Melinda was trying to write in the season. I'm forgetting which episode, but Picard and Riker do the phaser match together. They're doing the little phaser video game. And that's always a fun scene to do.
Phasers are much easier to do than, you know, fencing. Or
well, no one knows what proper phaser technique looks like, so you can kind of just make it up as you go along.
And you still don't know after you watch that.
Right, yeah.
Scene. And then the other one is the one with Worf and Guinan, which
yes.
is kind of funky.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
Which Guinan is great in this episode. Her scene wasn't cut, right? That was in the original cut.
Yes, that was it. In fact, Melissa talks about, as a freelancer coming in, which is when she wrote this, it was a very cool story about this being her spec script, and they buy it, which is like Ron Moore's spec script was The Bonding, and they bought it, you know, and Renee Ashvaria's spec script was The Offspring. that's a whole different story. The Offspring, all the Greeks. And but Renee was the one who, when they said, hey, we love this, and we will put you on staff, and he's the one that went, nah, I like living in New York. Mm. And we're like, what? And they took it. They begged him for like 2 years. Finally, he moved to L.A. with his wife. But yeah, it's to hear her say that was her spec script and that they bought it. And then by the time she got in there, realized, because you're an outsider, you don't know they've hired Whoopi Goldberg to play this new character.
Right.
As time's going on. So this was like midway in the season. I'm just looking at the dates on the script are all the rewrites are in December. So when they got done to film it, so.
You don't have a copy of the spec script, I imagine, Larry, do you? That would be gold if you had that original script that she submitted.
No, I mean, that's probably a thing of it's sitting in a box in the next to the Ark of the Covenant in Paramount in her own copy, if she even still has it.
Yeah.
So I found our file folders of our story document, like five different versions of Prophecy when it went through iterations as a story about the other day or couple months ago, we cleaning out the garage. I'm like, oh, good, here they are.
Oh, that'd be great to see.
They run the gamut from the simple bottle show to Michael Piller having it on an alien planet. We had a shuttlecraft crash at the beginning in the trees because it was so thickly. Anyway, we'll get out of that.
Well, when we get around to Prophecy again, we'll talk about that again.
Yeah.
For the 47th time.
But Whoopi's lines in here is another example of Whoopi really being the best counselor on the ship, as we talk about sometimes. But, you know, I remember when Whoopi came on the show, and, you know, prior to that, I had always seen Whoopi, well, as a comedian, really. I mean, I guess she had done Ghost at that point. But her performance on TNG is always amazing, and she was such a good addition to the show. And this episode for me, whether it's the original cut or the extended cut, you know, the beginning of the episode, the first half of the episode, it's kind of okay, but you get about halfway through and you hit this point where Whoopi and Picard start talking about what's really going on here, you know, and basically you're talking about creating a slave race. And then we get into the turn of events, like Melinda talks about the second stage rocket, where you're sending the story in another direction, where Louvois pits Picard and Riker against one another on two sides. And then Whoopi raises this, Guinan raises this question. And this is where it really takes off.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you guys a particular question about the Whoopi scene, because I'm a little confused about exactly the events of it. She starts talking about, you know, creating this race and what happens then. And Picard says, "You're talking about slavery." And Guinan has a very visceral reaction of, "Oh, no. You're going way too far. That's not what I mean." And Picard says, "No, that is what you mean." And it really changes his perspective. Do you think that is what she means? Because I felt like she was really laying it on hard, that she was talking about slavery. Like,
yeah.
You know, she may not be from Earth, but she knew what Earth history was. I'm sure it's not that different from other planets.
He says, "You're talking about slavery." She's laid that long speech on an army of Data's all disposable. As a leader, you wouldn't have to consider their feelings or their welfare. Generations of disposable people. "You're talking about slavery." "Well, that's very harsh." And he says, "No, it's not." No, I think that's like the parent, you know, it's kind of like reinforcing. You've had a light bulb moment, and she's like, "Well, now I didn't go that far." And he's like, no, but I am. And then she's like, "Good, because that's exactly where I wanted you to go. But I'm not about to tell you that, because you might not get it as much
right.
if I laid it on."
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
No, it totally plays.
She's
out.
Leading him right to the conclusion that she wants to take him to. And Guinan is masterful at that. We see it time and again.
And of course, the dynamic for Next Gen, what Marina would say was, when they first introduced Guinan, she's like, "Well, then what am I, you know, oh, thanks. I barely survived first season, and now you're going to take away from my counseling, you know, even more," which is why a lot of the shows, when you had Guinan in them in a major bit, it was like, okay, how are we going to balance, you know, what Troy could do with what Guinan could do? It was almost like a relief. It was like two things happened. The further they went along and Whoopi's career took off, they had her less and less, even though she still loved doing the show. And they made Troy more and more serious and put her back in the uniform and made her command school and all that. So it was almost like they both kind of worked itself out on different roads. But what you mentioned about her counseling really is the one that's counseling Picard. That was one of the dilemmas in those, you know, second, third, fourth seasons about what we do. But let me go back, because I had to go and look it up. That's the beauty of podcasting, because I can still go over something. You mentioned Ghost, Chris. Ghost was from 1990. I saw Guinan coming to this, the main thing I remember her having done was she was the dramatic, sympathetic character in victim character in The Color Purple.
Right.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know of her as a comedian. I mean, really, at the time. You know, we only had so many cable channels so back then. So I knew she was a celebrity, but I knew she, to me, it was like she'd done as much dramatic acting as comedy. So it wasn't that much of a leap to me to go, "Oh, okay, that's cool. They got a halfway, you know, some celebrity somewhere to jump in and do this."
I think that, you know, talking about the balance between Troy and Guinan, though, establishing the fact that Guinan and Picard had this back history together was really important, because that allowed Guinan to counsel him, plus the fact that she's so old, the character is so old, and Picard knows that she's very wise, even though she looks to be younger than Picard.
She's not that old, but the symbiont is very old. Oh, no, wait.
Well, I was going to go there, but that allowed this relationship between her and Picard is something that there's just no way that Troy could ever counsel Picard that way, no matter how good of a counselor she might be. But yeah, that's right, Larry. This is the Sisko and Jadzia relationship as well, where because of Curzine, you actually, I talked about this recently, actually, on The Orb, I think, that they flip-flop, you know, like Sisko and Dax will flip-flop. Like, sometimes Sisko's counseling Jadzia, sometimes Dax is counseling Sisko.
Yeah.
And that interpersonal relationship makes that possible.
it's part of why Picard is so cut off from the rest of the crew, especially in the first season. He doesn't have anyone to go to, because there's no one that knows him that well. You know, he's got this adversarial relationship with Riker. He doesn't know Troy enough to trust her, really. There's no one he can go to until Guinan comes on the show. That's something so strong about the original series, where Kirk always had Bones and even Spock. And as you say, Sisko had Jadzia and Janeway had the monkey. Picard just never had anyone he could talk to, except that they had Guinan there, you know. And then as she went away, like, eventually it became a family.
Are you calling Tuvok a monkey?
Oh, no. It's the monkey from Resolutions down on the planet that keeps popping up all the time. Every time she tries to take a bath.
Because Janeway had Tuvok as an old friend. I missed that episode, guys, where that leak went. Okay.
This is Lieutenant Monkey, the one that every time Chakotay made a move on Janeway on New Earth, the monkey would pop up and, you know, spoil the mood.
No, Janeway had Tuvok, and then Archer had Trip. So everyone but Picard had somebody they could go to. And I don't know if it was an oversight by the writers or what it was.
Well, no, wait a minute. Picard technically had Beverly. But maybe not the way
that was a romantic thing, like romantic tension there from the very start.
Well, I mean, but not as the advisor confidant.
Did it ever
strike you funny that you have to go back and remember this? Picard did not know Riker when he picked him to be his first officer.
Yeah.
He just went through the pile of resumes and pulled this guy out of a stack of paper. It wasn't like, I'm going to bring my best friend along that I want to see, you know. That just always floored me.
He had some criteria, officer. There had to be a K sound in the name, so that automatically eliminated, half of the potential candidates.
It had to be a middle initial of T that we will not disclose what it means until the animations. Until a late season.
Everyone on the Stargazer, he'd gotten everyone on the Stargazer killed, so they were all out. He really wanted Vigo, but I think Vigo was dead at that point.
So you'll have to settle for her missing son. Dum, dum, dum. Years later.
Yeah.
So let's jump to the courtroom scene. So get to kind of the heart of all of this. Right. And the heart
of this entire legal tangle to me, Chris, is I want to know what the hell are the Acts of Cumberland. No, I'm kidding. I want to know where Cumberland. I just see this little shack in the hills of, Kentucky somewhere with the Acts of Cumberland.
Some guy is distilling bourbon and writing acts for Starfleet in the hills of Kentucky.
Pipe in his big beard. Yeah. What are they doing at the Acts of Cumberland this week, Ma? Well, this week, Dad.
That must be Jim Beam the Fifth who's doing that.
Jim Beam me up. Thank you, David. Yeah. The central core issues of the trial. Yes. You were saying, Chris.
So, Greg, at what point in the theater were you openly weeping here?
when was the openly weeping? It was. I mean, it's during the big scene, Picard's big scene where he starts grilling Maddox and asks him about the three tenets of what makes someone sentient. And he says, well, he's passed two of your criteria. What if he passes the third? What about which one is it? It's consciousness. He says, what happens then? I don't know. Do you? And he asks, I think everyone in the courtroom, like including us, do you? And it's so powerful. It's so moving. And then the fact that he convinces the JAG officer in that, I always forget her name, but the JAG officer in that moment.
Louvois.
And she makes the speech about, well, I have to do something. And I guess I have to say that he's not property. And it's, I don't know what to do with it but cry for that. And the look on Data's face when he goes up to Maddox and says, look, I know you've been trying to kill me this whole time, but seriously, some of your ideas are intriguing, and we can work with each other in the future. It's moving stuff.
Although before that, Data gives me a line, which I'm going to start using at City Hall and everywhere. I formerly refused to undergo your procedure.
Yes.
When they want me to fill out paperwork and such, I'm using that line. But no, you're right. I mean, Patrick Stewart's performance in here is fantastic in this scene. Riker's bit is okay. The whole line about Pinocchio's strings have been cut is a little bit... I mean, it's the kind of thing I think it sounds good when you're writing it, but then when it's delivered. It's kind of.
Yeah, I felt like after they, but he goes and just suddenly, like, he asks permission to take the arm off, and then all of a sudden he pushes the button and Data slumps over and he makes a speech. He goes back, sits down, and they ask for a recess. I want to be like, can we please reactivate the defendant?
I've never turned a defendant on in court before. But, I guess so.
But yeah, he asks permission to take the arm off, but yet he just jabs the off switch.
Yeah.
It's the old one, too. You sneak it in. It's they're talking about Data's rights, but, you know, Riker had a great left there and just knockout. Sorry.
But this, you know, this was essentially, they're doing Dred Scott in space here. And I think it was on the surface, of course, we're talking about Data's rights and whether he can stay on the ship and all. But Picard has another great line here where he says that, you know, eventually they're going to figure out how to replicate Data. You know, it's not, this isn't really a question about Data. This is a question about how are we going to treat androids in the future? Because it's going to happen. You know, we're going to figure out how to make more Datas, and they're going to be everywhere in the future. How are we going to treat them?
Yeah, I mean, they set it up as we need to set this precedent. It's so important. This is the case that's going to decide this for generations. And LaVoie,
we're going to do it this backwater starbase way out here on the edge of, right. with an understaffed staff.
And that's where LaVoie basically says, I'm not going to. I'm not going to make a precedent. I'm going to say in this specific case right here, Data is not property. Now, that doesn't mean anything else. So in the end, it's not the big decision that Picard was pushing for. And in some ways, that's really disappointing.
It was her own little Bush v. Gore. Don't ever apply this to anything else. Yeah. Well, now that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that, actually, because to me, one of the annoying things in an otherwise wonderful episode is the very next year, it may have been new to all the new guys running around working on the show, but when they did The Offspring, and I just felt like that was a redo of all the issues of this show, only from a slightly different angle. You know, are you property or do you have your own rights? Okay, you got your own rights. Next time. Okay, now you create a daughter. You have rights to have her, or is she property? I'm like, didn't we just hash this out last year? But listening to it today again, and going back to the lines, and Guinan's bit about back to that scene just for a second, but that ties into all this about, you know, somebody down the line will just create a whole race of androids and blah blah blah. And I remembered it flashed me back to the end of Voyager when they started to develop the Doctor's holographic, photons be free, for some humor, but a lot of, people, the whole two-part hologram show with the independent holograms that Erosions, it was called Flesh and Blood, created. And it was a little bit of, oh, geez, are we going to rehash this, android or hologram, if it's artificial intelligence, it's artificial intelligence, are we going to rehash this again? And not that it wasn't an issue that needed to be debated, but to me, it was cool. And of course, turn Bob Picardo loose with any scene, but it was a little bit of, okay, are we going to rehash this issue again? Have we really had a turnover of generations from second season Next Gen to sixth or seventh season Voyager? But it's been long enough that we can revisit this. And
I mean, in some ways,
I'm not taking anything apart from the issue. I just, as far as Star Trek and it's going on, I just felt like they got back to this several times, and I don't know, but every time the good guys won and individual rights won out over big property because you're intelligent, but.
I feel like it's such a strong topic, and we know in real life these issues aren't solved by just one courtroom decision. So in a way, it makes a little bit of sense to keep rehashing the same episode over and over again. Data's gonna have to fight for his right, not to party, fight for his right to live for the rest of his life. I mean, that's just the reality of not being, not being a human.
Well, not being the quote-unquote normal mainstream majority of things.
Exactly.
Actually, I hadn't thought of it that way. Where were you in, 1990 when I was enjoying The Offspring, wondering why they were rehashing a concept 1 year later? You just did this. And the fact that if she declared this to be her one little case history, they didn't refer back to this too much.
Yeah. Plus, it's true.
I think that was partly the annoyance. I think the other annoyance of offspring. They didn't say, you know, we just went through this last year. I mean, that always lends weight to, you can get around a lot of stuff if you admit it up front that you're having to get around a lot of stuff.
Yes.
Like that. If you just, you know, take it head on. But
on Down in Front podcast, they call that hanging the lantern. Just say, yes, we know, but we're doing the episode anyway.
Yeah. So I'll take your explanation.
Okay.
Yeah. Plus, like you said, Greg, they didn't really resolve it here anyway. They only resolved it in terms of Data himself. And even if they do resolve it for androids, when the next thing comes around, it's all going to start over again. You know, with the Doctor, well, now it's holograms. Okay, so we figured out that androids are sentient and they have rights. But what about holograms? What about holograms that can't leave sickbay versus holograms that have a little magic emitter on their arm? You know?
Yeah, do hologram stream of life.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Well, and then we get to the issue of, you know, the ships.
Think of the exocomps! Okay.
Well, I mean, think of the ship's computer. I mean, the ship's computer is going to keep getting more advanced and more advanced. I think there is a novel where the ship's computer has a sentient AI. Livroy's question of, you know, what, you know, would you let the... Or does Maddox ask it, would you let the ship's computer refuse an overhaul? And they say, well, of course not. It's property. But, I mean, that issue is going to happen 20 years down the road when the computer is so smart that it's achieved sentience as well.
Only if it pouts in a female voice.
I was thinking about that, yes. Okay. Well, remember in Emergence, near the very end of the series, where, you know, they debate, is the ship coming alive? And Picard takes the position that, like, this is a new life form. We have to see what's happening here and where this is going.
Mm-hmm. It was this weird construct of, you know, no one's ever had 4,000 holodeck programs in one computer bank before. And, you know, that was what that was supposed to be. It was like a holographic, there we go.
I wonder what happens to Voyager. Riker's collection of Enterprise historical holonovels that he goes into to do his historic research then. Because he's probably got at least 4,000 of those. Then he's got 8,000 of his... programs with Minuet.
I was going to say Minuet. Yeah,
he definitely has all the Minuet action figures.
Now, here's one that we were like, in all scales. Here's that one little moment we kind of touched on it. But speaking of the deleted scenes, that one little moment was kind of goofy when I saw it for the first time in the party, right after he unwraps it. And Pulaski, gives him the book, and this is, it's a Klingon book, and it's, you know, and then she walks away, and in the extended scene, she gives him some advice, and her whole advice is, here's the wording of it, because I've got the, my advice, you've spent years in the womb of Starfleet, now you're about to start a new life. You'd be wise to consider the experiences offered by groundside living.
I heard that, I'm like, what?
Groundside, what, like, not like planetside. Yeah.
Terrestrial. What did she say?
I thought she was like on the side when she's not performing her medical duties. She's kind of like a Federation timeshare.
Yes.
That's the way she's coming in. Like, she's trying to sell you on a timeshare on Ryza. You know, groundside living, it has all the amenities you could ever want, Data.
Well, it feels like marketing speak, doesn't it? It feels like it's the way they had a big meeting and they all decided planet side isn't quite as good as groundside, so let's go with groundside. It's also like that scene in The Graduate where someone recommends that he go with plastics. It's like,
it's the whole thing. Yeah.
I didn't really ask for this advice. Okay.
Now, Larry, you have the actual script in your hands right there. Am I correct that there is a little more footage that was not put into the extended cut where she actually hands him a brochure?
Yes, that's amazing. No, she doesn't hand him a brochure, Chris. It's on a little isolinear optical chip.
Oh, that's true. She slid it into his back so he could just...
It's pink and orange and has a palm tree scent.
Oh.
Groundside living. It was like, is that like groundwater? Only it's groundside.
It was.
But, you know, but the bigger thing is that it's Pulaski who all of a sudden, you know, has been calling him property. It's kind of like Pulaski got usurped by Maddox's little shtick of calling him it. So she's like, and now she's going to run over to his side. It was, you know, it was, if it stayed in, it was kind of a,
well, she's like,
we've got Guinan, so we can't have Troy. Now we've got Maddox usurping you know, Pulaski's bit of calling him property. So I don't. It's nice that they're trying to show her have a heart when he's leaving. Yeah, but it struck me kind of odd of seeing this. Like, oh, that's right. He's kind of doing her thing.
It was a weird scene, and you almost felt like, man, has Pulaski been hitting the bottle before she came into the party, or what's going on here? It's like, what is she talking about?
I always felt like Pulaski had affection for Data. I mean, she didn't tag along into the Sherlock Holmes mystery because she hates Data. You know, she really feels like he's an interesting person, that he's growing. She just enjoys the process of needling him, of forcing him to grow. But I think scenes like this help expand the character and help us see, okay, there's more than just her mispronouncing his name and that sort of thing.
And it was very cool because something the Next Generation had the potential to do, that, like say the original series didn't, was to have a medical officer who got their jollies by needling the most intellectual person in the senior staff.
I was just
because
about
that
to say
would
this.
Be a whole new perspective on the 21st
I was just about to say that. Yeah, because a lot of people do see Pulaski that way, that she is Bones, right? And on the Next Generation.
So
she has to needle. She can't needle Spock, so.
But actually, to be pulled back from that, Mike actually asked Melinda in the commentary track about that she see Pulaski as just Bones. And she was like, no, she thought Bones had a heart of gold, that the cynic, you know, masked that. But that Pulaski really was a hard-drinking woman, hard-playing woman who'd been around a while. And so I was like, oh, okay, I hadn't thought of it. The writer's guide, they did do a one-page for Pulaski, and that this never got into the script, but they had wrote her as having been married and divorced three times to three different people.
Hmm. Well, we know she was with Kyle Riker.
Yeah, he was one of them. So you know, kind of like the Enterprise, she was a ship with some history. So,
well,
as Gene wanted the original Enterprise to be.
Right.
Let's talk about one more cut scene at the very end where Data and Riker have their conversation, and you know, Will, I think, is very upset about almost costing Data his life. And, you know, I thought Data had kind of a touching response, and I think also highlighted how Data is growing. I mean, what did you think about that interaction? Did it add something to the episode that you didn't get the first time around?
Well, elaborate. I mean, I can see when they made, I'm looking at it right here, I can see where they made the edit for time. Riker says, Data, I came this close to winning. And Data says, is it not true that had you refused, she would have ruled against me anyway? And he says, well, it injured you and saved me. I won't forget that. And you got the essence of it. All the three or four cut lines back and forth just kind of elaborated on that. And he says, in fact, now I didn't notice, I wasn't looking close enough to see, the way this was written was that Data actually took the step and called him, he says, I almost could have cost you your life. And this is in the lead scene. And Data moves in and says, yes, that is true. But Commander, Will,
yes,
I have learned from your experience.
Right.
And I don't remember, I have to go back and look and see if he actually did that. But if they did, that would have been very tough.
Well, he calls him Will in the extended cut.
Yeah, that goes into
the extended cut.
Like
that.
Yeah.
It was there. The Will.
Yeah.
Because he says, and then real quick, he says that at times one must deny their nature, sacrifice their own personal beliefs to protect another, which is what you mean about a growth spurt for Data, or verbalizing.
Yeah. I think what's in the extended doesn't change the core of the scene, but it does add those little moments like him calling him Will. It amps it up. It's such a great scene, and it, you know, Riker has such a hard arc in the episode. He goes from, you know, not being terribly involved to saying, well, no, I'm not going to do this. And then he really steps up and says, okay, if I have to prosecute Data, I will. And to the point of an extended edition saying, I'm going to win. Like, I'm really going to make it happen because that's my duty as a Starfleet officer. And you see how conflicted he is. And, you know, Melinda talks about, everyone says it's a Data episode. It's not really. It's actually a Picard episode. Well, where does that leave Riker? And the fact that at least we get this extended edition where we learn a little bit more about where Riker was at the end of it, I really appreciate that. Because he's always the character I want to see more of. So more Riker is better.
I always thought that Riker didn't crystallize. I always thought he was like just kind of really flawed. Not Jonathan's acting, but what they did with Riker, just kind of like threw him out there. It was like, well, he's going to be the Kirk end of the dynamic now. And, you know, he'll be the action guy that goes down the planet, since we won't put our character, our captain can't run and jump. So Patrick demands it.
Right.
Third season. I never thought Riker really crystallized to me as a character until Best of Both Worlds. And they came to that meme of, holy shit, it was like a little throwaway line in two or three shows, but suddenly we've got to this point where Riker's given up three commands, and they bring in Shelby, and all of a sudden, Picard's out of the picture, or even before he's gone, she's there, and you see him, and then he's going over to Troy and going, Jesus Christ, what's wrong with me? I've given that, and she's counseling him, you know, as a friend and as a professional. And all of a sudden, it was like, wow, where is this character been for 2.5 years? And this was watching the show again. This was a rare moment in all the mushy, high on hero, good looking guy who straddles chairs and leans funny. You know, it's like, it's like here's a moment where he actually had a little bit of meat thrown his way to deal with. And he did fine with it. You know, having to shift back and forth. I got to do my job, but I'm killing my friend. I got to do my job. And even when he's called up those, and I remember watching this back in the day on TV, on my round fronted TV, and when he called up those charts, on the tech head in me, when he called up the charts, and I was like, oh my God, I bet those aren't just numbered gibberish. That's really written out words. Oh my God, I want to see those words. You know, can we freeze frame that on my forehead, VCR? No, it's not. And at least I had to stop and go back. At least on the Blu-ray, you can read the first.
You can.
You know, the second one, it goes into, but you know, it's so huge. I know Mike had to have written, and you can tell it's real words. Mm-hmm. He wrote stuff out because they knew it was going to, and they kept it serious. They didn't, but here's my little trivia out of this episode. We were kidding on the other side of the room earlier, but I loved at the beginning, at the bottom, it was like personnel ID. And when you first saw it back in the day, it had like data.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what does that say in front of his name? What does it say in front of his name? And finally on a forehead, on a 4-head VCR, which was like the best you could do back in the day. And you pause, you know, record in 2-hour mode. I could read that it said NFN NMI data. And it was like, what does that mean? What does that mean? And one of the early letters I wrote Mike and Rick about, you know, just random nerd questions was I said NFM NMI, and they're like, it's no first name, no middle initial data, like for the fields of searching.
Right.
For their things. Like, oh, and then the second time I went, oh, that's what's on his little blue, you know, gym bag.
Right.
It says NFI.
It's the sort of thing where I was just like, I saw it long enough to be puzzled by it, but I didn't think about it hard enough to try to figure out what it was or try to pause it. But yet, now that I know that, it does make it a lot better, because it was just like gibberish data. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, at least they didn't have a little asterisk there that you see it, and then when you really get the fine tune in HD and Blu-ray, and it goes down, you see the asterisk line, the footnote says, you know, actually there is, but you can't pronounce it. So that was going to go a little too far. So.
I did like, just for a bit of behind the scenes, how Riker was first looking at a CRT monitor. He was doing a little touchscreen stuff, and then he moved over, and they obviously had a big projection screen hooked up. I just would have loved to have been in Mike's shoes here, designing it, figuring out how to get it on screen, just making all these little bits. It's really fascinating to watch, especially when it wasn't just putting a big, you know, LCD panel. They had to actually build it into the set.
Yep, and do it in 15 minutes. Can you do that? No, I probably had a little more time. Well, and you heard he tells that story too, which happened all the time on things, where, you know, the prop or the vendor-made off-lot thing shows up on the day of filming, because that's just the way they would have loved to have had it earlier. But it just shows up the day of filming, and they come in, and when the guy that made the arm, whoever Mike Westmore had to make the arm, comes in, and it's a very bland joint. And Mike came up and said, actually, he would have walked down the ramp to over their office and said, guys, can you dress this up? And they're digging around doing the time-honored, you know, finding plastic scraps in their desk drawers and gluing them on to give it some texture. You know, he said pin caps and, you know, odds and end crap they had laying around. And that was back when their staff was, I mean, literally it was like him, and it was second season. It would have been Richard, James, and one or two. You know, they didn't have 3 or 4 people in the mold of Anthony Frederickson and some of the people as the art staffs got bigger over the years. Early on, it was just them. So anyway, that was a fun little bit. Everything you see there was thrown onto that, you know, 15 minutes before they started shooting.
It is visually interesting, and I don't know if it showed up in the original, but now you look at that joint and it's got a bunch of little bits stuck onto it. It is fancy and cool. You wonder what is all of that, but I guess it makes sense because there's like sensors in there and lots of little data actuators and whatnot.
Yeah. Plus it has to it's kind of like when you have a freeway construction. You can't just, how are you going to upgrade or add a lane? You have to figure out where you're going to put the traffic, you know, while you're
right.
working. That's your thing. So it's like, not only do we have to show how the connections are made, but Riker just like gives it one twist and it's off. So
yeah.
It has to have the, you know, the easy interface. What's the PC word for that?
Plug and play.
It has to have the plug and play interface to it. So.
Well, plus Riker is really good at, you know, taking things off. So. All right. Well, we have passed an hour, so there's so much to talk about here and such.
Yeah.
Why don't we
there's all these obscure trivia, like first poker game and first. I know, there's a lot of firsts in this show.
Yeah, it was the first poker game. So let's do final thoughts. Anything else you want to touch on that we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, well, I mean, my final thoughts is mostly what we've talked about. The one thing I started to get into was the sets. I like the sort of hastily put together courtroom set. Memory Alpha tells us that it's probably in Larry's book that it's the battle bridge that they've reassembled. But it's a cute little set. You know, you feel like there would be more people there.
It's a cute little set.
But, you know, they are off in the middle of nowhere. You do wonder, does this ever actually get resolved? We say in The Offspring again, it never actually, it's still, you know, it's brought up again. They can't decide, are androids sentient or not? And then we get brought up with holograms. Like, eventually down the road, do they have a big actual trial, like, in San Francisco and bring the actual people there? Like, has Maddox grown? Like, that's another novel that I'd love to see. Like, the sequel to this, where they do make that, you know, actual.
When the Federation
precedent.
Supreme Court
exactly.
takes it on or something.
Right.
Yeah.
The Measure of a Maddox.
Well,
now this is
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is, okay. Very quickly, this was the first time they mentioned Daystrom Institute as an homage to Daystrom from Ultimate Computer. And this was the movie set redo, and they used it, you know, the sea bridge and all kinds of things. Actually, I wanted Picard to walk in the room and start to talk to a couple of captains, and they have them all give him the cold shoulder, you know, and it'd be a little homage to court. Okay, I'm kidding, to court martial.
Right.
It did remind me of that brief scene. It did get into it a little bit where they talk about the novel, the Klingon novel and all that. There was a time, and this was Maury Hurley's thing, and then they dropped it, but there was a time when they were almost trying to do like the equivalent of the Chekhov joke with Russian stuff.
Yeah.
In second season, they got into trying to do that with Worf and Klingons. So the Klingon love poetry and the Klingon tea party and, you know, that kind of stuff. And this was another example of where they were trying to do the, you know, just like they tried to do the French joke with Picard at the beginning and dropped it immediately. You know, you remember like the first couple in Farpoint, he says, "Oh no, we should see the much, much more patriotic red, white, and blue of the French tricolor." And Data's like, "Really?" And people in the audience are going, "Really? Really?" Okay. Especially if it's when you're watching it back. What was cool about the track on this one, the audio that they were talking, Melinda, I think, or no, Mike did it, was, now that I think about it, those panels in the Starbase, the lounge, you know, area where they meet, were kind of a big thing for them. And then to find out that was from Coming to America, I was like, oh, I actually remember that scene from their, you know, the African Kingdom, Eddie Murphy's movie. And it was really funny. It was like, oh, that's right, because it was a Paramount movie. And they probably were shooting it at the same time, if you go back and compare them. They were probably on some stage and said, hey, guys, we'll... don't scrap those. Well, can we just, like, borrow those? Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it could have been as flimsy. You know, pay us a $5 rental. Okay. And they got but those big loopy 80s-looking, graphic panels that were in the backsides of that on either side of the stair were kind of – anyway, another wacky – it has nothing to do with the wonderment of the pros in the courtroom scene.
That explains the concessions over in the courtroom where they had all the McDougal's burgers.
Yeah. it was funny hearing it, because I remember at the time watching this and knowing that Melinda had worked with George R. R. Martin. And I was my brain is still conditioned to think George R. R. Martin doing the Beast. George R. R. Martin doing the Beast. And for her to go, of course, he's writing this little thing called Game of Thrones. Like, oh, yeah, that. Okay, well, that's that Johnny Come Lately thing. Yes. But, you know, don't forget Beauty and the Beast. But anyway. Yeah, it was a great show. It was a great show. And my personal memory of this is I didn't even see it the whole thing the first time because I was seeing – I had driven down to see a friend of mine in Houston down from Oklahoma. And I got there later than I thought, and he was watching Next Gen, but I walked in right in the middle of the show, so I didn't even see the beginning of it. And it's not cemented in my head as the measure of for years in my concordance that I did ages ago in my database, I had it down as the measure of the man instead of a man. And I've had to like beat it into my head over the years too. And now it's like I get confused. And, you know, is it A or D? Is it A or D? I mean, the Shakespearean reference is a man.
Right.
I forget I go by that.
Well, I remember this one from when it came on, and it was always one of my favorites because of the message. And I'm generally, you know, when things come out and they have the extended footage, I'm not always a big fan of it. I mean, the one, Greg may disagree with me here, but one recent one was Battlestar Galactica's extended cut of Razor, which I felt after watching it, like, okay, I understand why they trimmed this down.
Yeah, definitely. So say we all!
But in this case, the extra footage here, with the possible exception of ground living, really added to this episode for me and made it an even stronger episode.
And the Axe of Cumberland, yeah, in the cabin.
Well, it's actually the Axe of
seriously.
Cumberbatch, because Harrison's going to come back and detonate the laws and all that they stand for.
So you think we were being conned even then? Is that what you're saying? Well, it should be noted. We should note that this, you know, Melinda says this was her first script sale. It was a spec script, and she was nominated for a Writers Guild Award for this script. Didn't win, but she, which is, you know, shows you the power of it.
It's one of the best TV scripts that I can think of, just period. So I'm really amazed by her. I can't wait to listen to the commentary. I didn't have time this afternoon. That commentary I'm really excited for, and even to rewatch the little behind the scenes video that they showed at the theatrical event. It was really cool hearing her just talk about the story.
It is good. If you don't have the Blu-rays yet, there's a lot of stuff on there. There's the original cut of this. There's the extended cut. There's the commentary track with Mike and Denise and Melinda. And there's a hybrid version as well, where they actually splice in VHS footage showing where they put the cuts in. So there's a lot of stuff on there.
But, and I don't even mind it going from color to black and white.
Right. It's very, very interesting. So this is one of my favorite.
Yeah,
a cage reference, yes. There's like six versions of the cage. There's the black and white one. There's the restored one. There's the remastered one. There's probably cuts we've never even seen.
There's the animated one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, there's the one that's recreated using Sims.
Yes.
Yeah. So many of those. They have to keep putting some new ones out for every DVD release. But I love this episode. It's one of my favorite TNG episodes. You know, it does what Star Trek does really well, although not as consistently, perhaps, as we would like, of taking on a big issue and really addressing it. And in the case of TNG, it's kind of unique in that it takes an issue like this and it really leaves the gray area there. You know, they don't really make a decision. They don't. It's not a black and white thing like we typically would get. Which I really love. So I am going to give this episode 10 carnival performers.
Yes. In that vein, I would be sure to give this show 10 out of 10 detached arms.
Oh, well, catching me flat footed, but I'll agree with you on that. I have to give this show 10 modified corncob pipes for Sherlock use. And the last admonition that if any big Anakin fans are out there, to be on the lookout for an Anakin watch in this episode. Anakin Skywalker. I mean Anakin, as in the Antikins and Seelick. There's Starbase 173 has an Anakin wandering around loose, untamed, looking for food. So, oh, and you know what else? This script has a reference to Romulans and the neutral zone and activity.
Oh.
That's a setup to that they started with neutral zone, and it's another thing while Maury Hurley is trying to introduce the Borg later on. One of the few things Nakamura mentions is some activity along both sides of the Romulan neutral zone.
Interesting.
And that was when they were trying to, you know, the scoop out planets that they both, they were going to blame each other over it in neutral zone and found that it was happening to both of them. And they were like, we're going to have to keep an eye, a watch on this. And that was all setting the seeds in to lead up to what finally turned into Hugh Who.
Yes.
There you go.
Planting the seeds. All right. Well, Larry, thanks as always for joining us. Tell everyone where they can find you if they want to find out more about what you have going on.
Well, I'm down at the end of a dark alley at the 400 block of LarryNemechek.com is probably the best overall way to find me, or Twitter at Larry Nemechek. My Trekland, my Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook is good. And all, you know, Con of Wrath and my Trekland on CCD. Trekland on speaker CD that you kindly helped remaster and design, and all my stuff, news about playing McCoy, my secret project now, all the cool stuff happening in Trekland is at LarryNemechek.com.
You know, Chris, one of the most striking things about Measure of a Man that we never got a chance to talk about is that this actually comes out of the writer's strike in 88, that Melinda actually pitched the show in the first season. And then when they had this dearth of scripts because of the writer's strike, they just needed scripts. And that's really the only reason they pulled this one out and asked her to come in and actually do a rewrite and make it good for the second season.
Well, that is amazing. I mean, it shows that sometimes good things happen when you're short on resources. Because, I mean, she was a real find for them, and it's another case. I mean, we talked about yesterday's Enterprise before and how they were like throwing that together and they thought it was going to be a mess, and it turns out to be one of the classics, you know. And this is another case where this was kind of a different kind of script for them. And as you say, it came out of that and turned out to be one of the classics.
Really is. I mean, it was worth buying the season two set for. I mean, sure, Elementary, My Dear Data, and Shades of Grey, of course. But this is really the one that I bought the set for.
It is. I actually tweeted that last night. I told people, if you don't have this set, go buy it for this extended cut, as well as the commentary, which we talked about, you know, throughout the feature today.
Yeah, I cannot wait to get to that. That's probably going to be my next thing when I pop in the Blu-rays, listen to that commentary track. Because it's not just her, not just Melinda, it's also Mike and Denise Okuda.
Yeah, it's really good. You definitely should go do that right after we record the show. All right. Well, let's tell everyone where to find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on The Measure of a Man or anything else we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can choose to send to a show, choose the Ready Room. That'll come to Greg and me. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And you can come over to the site and join in the conversation on our new forums. There's a dedicated area there for the Ready Room as well as the Next Generation. And that's at trek.fm/forums. And of course, you can find us on Twitter under username trekfm. Greg, where can people find you?
Well, they can definitely, first of all, find me on the Observation Lounge, which is the other side of the other side of the room, where we talk about more geeky topics than Star Trek, things other than that happened during the week. We have a great time on that show. It's just an hour long, so if you have just one extra commute that you need a podcast for, pop in the Observation Lounge. And the other place is on the Twitter. I'm there at Greg Harbin, and when I'm not talking about my pink 3DS, I'm actually talking about the Star Trek rewatch that I've just embarked on with my girlfriend, where we're actually watching Star Trek in production order. Now, if you're not familiar, that means The Cage, then Where No Man Has Gone Before, and then, now what would be the next one? It's The Corbomite Maneuver, then Mudd's Women, then The Enemy Within, and then today we've finally gotten to, it's hard to keep track because it's so different from, it's The Man Trap, which was the first aired episode.
Right.
This is not an order I'm used to. It's so weird, but it makes
really
so much more sense. It makes more sense when you're watching it. It's like there's more of a progression of the characters. You can see, you know, Leonard getting into his character more. You can see McCoy more and more becomes a character as he's not in the first few, and then he enters the show and becomes an important part. By the Man Trap, he's been in 3 episodes. We understand him a little bit more than when you just jump in with the Man Trap. Anyway, check that out. We've got a hashtag GoingBoldlyTOS. That's going to be, you know, the next 5 years of my life. So feel free to follow along.
Yeah, TOS season 1 does make more sense if you watch it in that order, because it does jump everywhere. Just quick question on this, Greg. Now, as you work through the later series, are you going to watch truly in production order? So are you going to interweave The Next Generation and DS9 and Voyager and watch each episode in production order of the franchise?
So that's going to be a question. I definitely want to watch it interleaved, where I'm watching TNG and DS9 at the same time, then DS9 and Voyager at the same time, and even including the movies. We want to do the movies in order. Question comes up with weird bits like Unification, where they actually film part 2 first because of Nimoy's availability.
Yeah.
Might fudge it there a little bit.
I think you should fudge it there personally. Yeah. I mean, it's one story. It just happened to be split into 2 parts.
Right. But outside of TOS, it's mostly about, yes, I want to make sure I'm interweaving and watch the show as it was made. But TOS is going to be the one that's most changed by that, because they did so much just reordering of episodes wantonly, it seems like.
Yeah, well, it sounds like fun. You're going to have to stick with it. That's a long process right there.
It's going to be quite a thing.
Well, if you want to find me, I am on Twitter as well. My username is CBrianJones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much anywhere in social media under that username. You can also find me here on the network on The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk about Deep Space Nine, and on Literary Treks, again with Matthew Rushing, where we talk about books and comics, and we have a lot of interviews with the authors. Our interview coming up, it'll already be out by the time this Ready Room drops, this week was with David R. George III.
And I really can't wait to hear that one, because as we've discussed, he's the guy who wrote the novella about what if happened if they had written Picard off the show in Best of Both Worlds. I believe it's in The Cold Hands of something. Now I'm forgetting it. It's in the book Shattered Light. If you're ever in a bookstore and you see Shattered Light, in The Cold Hands of the Prophet, something like that, do really check it out. It's so great. Did you guys manage to touch on that story, or was it all about his new book?
No, we touched on all of that, actually.
Oh, good.
Pretty much, maybe not every single novel, but the wide range of his work. And then we got into his new book, Allegiance and Exile, towards the end of the interview. So there's, a lot of stuff in there. So go check that out at trek.fm/LT for Literary Treks. All right. And of course, we want to thank our sponsor, Squarespace. It's the quickest and easiest way to build a blog or a website. And it's also the most powerful hosting that you'll find. You really cannot bring down a Squarespace site with their grid hosting. Fantastic CMS. You'll absolutely love it. Go try it free for 14 days. No credit card required. And then when you decide to sign up, and we're sure you will, you can use offer code TREK2 to get 10% off, and that's over at squarespace.com/trek. All right, Greg. Well, that's another Ready Room. I'm going to wander off and find Pulaski, because I really want to find out what all groundside living has to offer me.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a foil in it, because the Ready Room is done.